The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition, from which I'll be reading, is dated July 7, 2025. The cover of Time Magazine, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. The special report is on the new Middle East, and the cover photo is partly torn away. It shows a Middle Eastern figure. He has gray facial hair, glasses, and a black, I'm going to say turban, that may not be the correct term. But the photo is like dappled with paper on top of it, and then part of it's peeled away, so it's not an entire photograph, but that is the cover image. And we'll begin with the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. The presidential election in Poland delivered the latest anti-incumbent surprise in what has been a tough period for establishment candidates the world over. The right-wing populist Karol Nawrocki, a historian with no political experience, won a narrow victory in a June 1 runoff vote over a candidate aligned with centrist Prime Minister Donald Tusk and his plans for closer European integration. Nawrocki, N-A-W-R-O-C-K-I, was to take office August 6. Tusk must now buckle up for a bumpy ride. With a presidential veto, Nawrocki will halt Tusk's bid to liberalize abortion law and overhaul a court system packed with judges politically aligned with the previous far-right government led by the Law and Justice Party, PIS, a change demanded by the European Union. But Nawrocki won't just block Tusk's reform plans. He will also work to exploit potential divisions within Tusk's four-party governing coalition, particularly among lawmakers in the conservative Polish People's Party, still the weakest link in Tusk's alliance. In fact, the one-point presidential election loss for his ally, Rafał Trzaskowski, leaves Prime Minister Tusk a lame duck, and it underlines the growing frustration of many Poles with a rising cost of living and the now long-term presence of up to 2.5 million Ukrainian refugees across the country. While support for Ukraine's defense and fear and loathing of Russia span most of Poland's political spectrum, a sluggish economy leaves many feeling Ukrainians should return home. A recent survey by Poland's Center for Public Opinion Research found support for accepting Ukrainian refugees dropped from 81% in early 2023 to just 50% in March. Nawrocki's ability to block Tusk's agenda will leave more voters fed up with Tusk's government, boosting right and far-right parties ahead of parliamentary elections in 2027. It has not been all bad news for Tusk. He comfortably survived a no-confidence vote June 11. He will now make changes to the government itself and focus only on the more broadly popular policies. Tusk will likely downsize the number of ministries, particularly for economic management, and placate key coalition partners with important new jobs. His government will prioritize social policies and new subsidies to take some of the edge off voters' anxieties over Poland's economy, push plans to make housing more affordable, avoid policies they know the new president will veto. Tusk's party will also try to undercut the right's hold on anti-immigration sentiment by focusing on border protection with tougher laws. Even before the election, Tusk pushed through a temporary suspension of the right to asylum, bringing his government closer to the anti-immigrant positions of the far right. But these have been coping tactics, not a roadmap to winning the next elections. Its political base expects Tusk's Civic Platform Party to loosen abortion restrictions. Since 2021, Polish law has permitted abortion only in cases of rape, incest, or a serious threat to a woman's life or health. His supporters also want him to restore rule of law in the country after the previous PIS government undermined the independence of some of Poland's political institutions. But elections have consequences, as Dick Cheney, the former U.S. vice president, now in the political wilderness, once said. Noraki will use the powers of the presidency to undermine Tusk on the European stage. He cannot make foreign or security policy, but he can use his political alignment with Donald Trump and Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, as well as criticism of EU conformity, to remind leaders across Europe Poland remains a polarized place and a shaky long-term bet for closer alignment with the bloc's policies and political values, in particular, support for neighboring Ukraine and its European aspirations will face new hurdles. Though Noraki supports Ukraine's war effort, he opposes EU and NATO membership for Ukraine and will push for cuts to benefits to Ukrainian refugees still in Poland. The new president will not have the power to create policy himself, but his willingness to criticize increasingly unpopular pro-Ukraine measures will make life much more difficult for Ukrainians and for Tusk. The View essay under the heading Education, The Truth and Sanity of American History by James T. Kloppenberg, that's K-L-O-P-P-E-N-B-E-R-G, Kloppenberg is Charles Warren Research Professor of American History at Harvard University and author of Toward Democracy, The Struggle for Self-Rule in European and American Thought. I am a history professor at one of the universities under attack by the Trump administration. I'm also a flag-waving patriot with an abiding love of the U.S. Those two statements might seem surprising or contradictory if you do not know what's happened to the teaching and writing of American history in the past 50 years. Earlier this year, President Donald Trump issued an executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. It asserts American historians have rewritten American history and replaced objective facts with a distorted narrative driven by ideology rather than truth. That is not true. There has been a change, but it has been driven by facts rather than ideology. Why do historical interpretations change? We expect medicine to make progress thanks to new scientific research, but isn't the past over? No, it is not. In the middle of the 20th century, understandably proud of America's indispensable role in defeating totalitarian autocracy, historians tended to emphasize our nation's undeniable achievements. Especially since the 1960s, in part because of the black freedom struggle, feminism, and other social movements that challenged prevailing distributions of power in the U.S., historians have been asking different questions and probing other dimensions of our past. Combining old and new methods, including the discovery of previously unknown sources and the use of statistical analysis, historians digging in the archives have uncovered solid evidence concerning the expansion of freedom for many Americans and the denial of freedom for many others. The experiences of enslaved Africans, women, indigenous people, ordinary soldiers, owners of small businesses, and countless other Americans have emerged from a generation's painstaking research into a new light. Historians have delivered these truths to the public with the understanding that our entire history should be known. Such knowledge, fully consistent with patriotism, provides an indispensable foundation for debates about contemporary issues. We should, of course, tell stories about the undeniable virtue and valor so many Americans have shown. But to see American history as simply a narrative of heroism would be a lie, unbecoming a great nation. What are historical facts? It is not so simple. Fans of vintage television will remember Sergeant Joe Friday, who insisted witnesses give him just the facts. This is one way to see history, as nothing but an unvarnished chronicle of what happened. But history, like life, is more complicated. From the almost infinite array of information historical actors leave behind them, historians put together interpretations consistent with recognized rules of evidence and reasoning. No generation of scholars can escape the intellectual climate of their own time, and the upheavals in recent decades have reshaped historians' questions and their answers to those questions. Critically engaging with the prejudices of the present, as well as those of the past, is central to historians' role. For decades, historians have been working to provide the public with knowledge about our history grounded in hard facts, knowledge that the president's order wrongly characterizes as the product of unprofessional bias. The integrity of historical scholarship is crucial in a democracy. Articles appear in scholarly journals and books are published by university presses only after a rigorous, double-blind review process. The identities of authors and reviewers are masked to ensure the evidence and reasoning meet the profession's highest standards. Fiery critiques are subject to equally fiery responses from members of the historical profession, who insist that passion cannot take the place of carefully marshaled evidence. That is as it should be. If the pendulum has swung too far toward critique and away from acknowledging progress, and a new balance must be struck, that work must be done by conscientious scholars and teachers, not by political partisans who clamor for viewpoint diversity while trying to impose their own views on all Americans. The executive order contends that revisionist historians present the American past as inherently racist, sexist, oppressive, or otherwise irredeemably flawed. The reality is that one-sided judgments, whether celebrations or condemnations, are met by dissent within the profession. However, errors and misjudgments should be identified and corrected, not by government officials who demand a particular narrative of our nation's past, but by scholars and teachers adhering to the profession's demanding standards. Historical facts never speak for themselves. Historians must always balance their own convictions and their own aspirations for our nation's future against the available evidence. Although entitled to their opinions, historians are never entitled to their own facts. The idea that there are no objective facts, only perceptions, has gained traction in recent decades. Our current president told more than 30,000 documented lies during his first term in office, and he shows no sign of slowing down. Historians cannot permit that approach to our nation's past. Politicians' attempts to police our publications, our classrooms, our museums must fail. We must defend the integrity and independence of historical scholarship. Telling Americans only those parts of our complicated history consistent with preconceived notions of American grandeur is unacceptable to everyone who cherishes our nation and its history. Otherwise, we approach the nightmare world of Stalin's Soviet Union or George Orwell's 1984, in which truth is whatever people in power say it is. Historians bear a responsibility to craft accounts of our nation's past firmly grounded in evidence. Without reliable history, Americans cannot know that our Constitution, framed by a generation that fought a bloody war against monarchy 250 years ago, erected sturdy barriers protecting us against executive overreach. Without reliable history, Americans cannot know that the judiciary has a duty to protect those barriers at a time when the majority in Congress has abdicated its responsibility to rein in this president's unconstitutional and illegal actions. The stories we tell ourselves as a nation must be consistent with objective facts. But they should also be consistent with our democratic ideals, our commitments not only to liberty and individual rights, but also to equality and justice for all. Turning the page to When Religion Was Forced on Americans by John A. Ragosta, R-A-G-O-S-T-A, who's author of Religious Freedom, Jefferson's Legacy, America's Creed. Before the American Revolution, many colonies had established churches supported with tax dollars, or imposed religious restrictions on voting or holding office. There was no separation of church and state. In Virginia, the most populous colony, everyone paid a tax to support the Anglican Church, which controlled marriage, poor relief, care of orphans, and enforced laws regarding profanity and church attendance. If religious dissenters died, leaving young children, Anglican officials would often place them in an Anglican home. Dissenters who failed to attend Anglican services regularly were often fined. Even so, religious dissent grew, led by evangelical Presbyterians and Baptists. So establishment supporters chased ministers with dogs, threw rocks, occasionally fired shots. Men on horseback whipped gathered worshipers. A hornet's nest was thrown into one prayer meeting. By the time of the revolution, over half the Baptist ministers in Virginia suffered jail time on charges of disturbing the peace or preaching without a license. Many countered that their license came from King Jesus. But with dissenters accounting for as much as one-third of Virginia's population, Patriot leaders realized their support was desperately needed in the fight against Britain. Dissenters demanded religious freedom as their price for supporting the war, and many religious restrictions were removed. But at war's end, reforms were incomplete. When supporters of the old Anglican order sought to impose a new church tax in 1784, evangelical dissenters rallied. One Baptist minister wrote, "The unlawful cohabitation between church and state, which has so often been looked upon as holy wedlock, must now suffer a separation and be put forever asunder." In the General Assembly, James Madison introduced Thomas Jefferson's Statute for Religious Freedom, which became a foundation for the First Amendment. And over time, a strong movement steered toward separation of church and state. A unanimous Supreme Court embraced the principle in 1879, and as recently as 1990, Justice Antonin Scalia explained in Employment Division v. Smith that religious exemptions to neutral laws wrongly entangle government and religion. But then, in the poorly named Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, Congress overturned the principle and put the burden on the government to oppose such exemptions. Now, if a law prohibits a business from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation, a business might try to refuse serving a same-sex couple citing religious beliefs. A business or hospital opposed to birth control might claim an exemption from government health care or insurance regulations. In 2017, President Trump sought to expand such religious exemptions by executive order, promising more church-state entanglements. In the past, this type of exemption was used by businesses discriminating against African Americans, claiming they suffered the curse of Ham from a biblical story interpreted as justification for race-based slavery. That was in 2017. If such exemptions are permitted, people will attempt to justify other illegal actions based on religion. Jefferson and his supporters understood such mixing of church and state corrupts both. In 2005, when the Supreme Court struck down a courthouse display of the Ten Commandments, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor channeled Jefferson by asking, "Those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state, why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?" The question rings true today. From the brief Brace for Summer, Don't We Know It, by Simone Shaw. What is at stake as Trump targets experts on climate and heat? Experts predict this summer might be hotter than average, and the U.S. is not prepared to meet the challenge. Much of the Midwest and Northeast is forecast to see temperatures persistently above average, according to a Weather Channel prediction, while the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center estimates the entire country will see above normal temperatures, the only difference being in severity. This comes as the Trump administration has conducted layoffs on climate and heat-related initiatives and cut funding for research grants on extreme heat. Experts warn this will risk the country's ability to protect communities from extreme heat. Heat experts at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, and the National Integrated Heat Health Information System, NIHHIS, were told in early April their positions would be eliminated as part of the cuts made by the Trump administration's Department of Governmental Efficiency. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's entire environmental health unit was cut, though some jobs were restored mid-June. What was lost there is a giant value to communities, says V. Kelly Turner, associate professor of urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. Extreme heat is not recognized as a disaster in the U.S., despite its being the largest weather-related killer in the country. Heat deaths have doubled in the past 24 years, and the number has been steadily rising since 2016. According to a study published last August in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. Despite this, the issue has long lacked the same federal resources given to other natural disasters. Heat actually does not have a home in the federal government, says Turner. Fires or hurricanes have programs and institutions and policies and funding streams associated with them. Heat did not have any of that. Previous administrations were only beginning to address the issue. The Obama administration founded NIHHIS, an interagency network aimed at providing solutions to protect people from extreme heat, which remained operational throughout the first Trump administration. Last July, a working group convened by the Biden administration published the first ever National Heat Strategy, which has since been removed from government websites. The Bipartisan Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, dedicated funds toward climate resilience projects, but the future of the law's many provisions remains unclear. The government was catching up, says Turner. We only kind of got halfway up the hill. Now we're rolling the ball back down. Communities in the U.S. are already woefully underprepared to address extreme heat management, and experts say cuts will only worsen the response. We are not prepared for the heat we are experiencing today, let alone the heat we will experience due to climate change. We are a nation unprepared for extreme temperatures, says Ladd Keith, director of the Heat Resilience Initiative. Really, we need a whole government approach to address extreme heat, and it needs to be especially aimed at supporting small local communities that do not have the resources to address it on their own. In mid-June, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, held a public hearing on the creation of a first-of-its-kind proposal for federal heat health standards for workers. But experts say it could be at risk after the Trump administration fired federal heat experts from NIOSH in the spring. The general consensus is, among labor advocates and those who've been working on the OSHA rule, it will probably not survive the rulemaking process, says Keith. Both Keith and Turner were working on the Center for Heat Resilient Communities, an IRA-funded program aimed at helping local communities come up with their own heat action plans. However, the day before they were expected to announce the first cohort of cities taking part, their funding was cut by the administration. The loss of programs like these means either other programs will have to step up or communities will be left alone, and we will have to reinvent the wheel, says Keith. The funding cuts, Turner says, highlight a dichotomy between the Trump administration's aim to leave disaster response to communities and the lack of tools they have to respond. There's a general trend right now of saying the federal government should not have a hand in addressing disasters at all, and that that should be a state-by-state issue or a community-by-community issue, she says. The problem is that would be an unfunded mandate, and I do not know that there is the knowledge store, and there definitely is not the financial wherewithal to actually address heat in that way. The brief news, health. AI helped a couple get pregnant after 19 years. By Alice Park. Doctors at Columbia University Fertility Center have reported the first pregnancy using a new AI system in a couple who had tried to conceive for nearly two decades. The pregnancy was possible because of an advance developed by Dr. Zev Williams, director of the center, to address azoospermia, A-Z-O-O-S-P-E-R-M-I-A, or a lack of detectable sperm in semen. About 40% of infertility in the U.S. is due to a male-related issue, and azoospermia is responsible for about 10% of those cases. Until recently, there was little doctors could do to address the lack of sperm needed to fertilize an egg, other than using donor sperm. Williams and his team spent 5 years developing a novel system that combined an AI algorithm for detecting sperm with a fluidic chip that passed the semen sample through a tiny tubule on a plastic chip. If AI picked up sperm, the smallest cell in the body, that tiny portion of semen would be directed to a separate tubule and collected. The few sperm isolated in this way could then be stored, frozen, or used to fertilize an egg. Called STAR, that's in caps, for sperm track and recovery, the system was inspired by similar AI approaches that astrophysicists use to detect new stars and planets. If you can look into a sky that's filled with billions of stars and try to find a new one or the birth of a new star, then maybe we can use that same approach to look through billions of cells and try to find that one specific one we're looking for, says Williams. I liken it to finding a needle hidden within 1,000 haystacks. But it can do that in a couple hours. And so gently, the sperm we recover can be used to fertilize an egg. Williams remembers the moment he was convinced. To test the system, before we discarded samples where embryologists could not find any sperm, we decided to run those samples through the system. The embryologists really worked hard to find sperm, since they did not want to be outshone by a machine. In one of the samples they analyzed for 2 days and found no sperm, STAR found 44 in an hour. For Rosie and her husband, STAR was the key to starting their family. Rosie, who asked to use a pseudonym to protect her privacy, says their Orthodox Jewish faith kept them hopeful. During 15 unsuccessful IVF cycles over almost 20 years, they had explored multiple options to address her husband's azoospermia. including surgery, and enlisting an international expert to manually analyze and isolate sperm from the samples. They also researched controversial methods to extract sperm that involved using chemicals that could potentially be detrimental to sperm quality. There really was nothing else out there, says Rosie, who's 38. Using the novel system did not require any additional testing or procedures. Their successful IVF cycle in March proceeded no differently than any of the other cycles they had experienced. We were keeping our hopes to a minimum after so many disappointments, says Rosie. Why should this be any different? But this time it was. Within 2 hours of collecting her husband's sperm that March, they learned Rosie's eggs had been successfully fertilized. Now 4 months along, Rosie's receiving standard obstetric care, and her pregnancy is proceeding well. I still wake up in the morning and cannot believe if this is true or not, she says. William says azoospermia is only one of many infertility issues AI could potentially address. There are things going on that we are blind to right now, but with the introduction of AI, we are being shown what those things are. The dream is to develop technologies so that those who are told you have no chance of being able to have a child can now go on to have healthy children. The End of an Era by Carl Vick. There's a photo here. There. Okay, the caption reads, Iranians protest Israel's attacks on Tehran, June 14. This is a beautiful structure in this photo. It's in color. It's a golden dome atop something that actually looks like fabric, but it looks like it's replicating all of the beautiful gold and silver and white mosaic work in the Muslim world. It's a huge crowd, huge, probably thousands of people packed into this square in which the photograph's being taken. They're holding flags, mostly red, white, and green, and in the background there's a huge banner in blue with gold Arabic characters on it. More buildings in the background also, most of them multi-story, looking like tan or beige brick. The background is a pale blue sky. It might be difficult to discern through the black clouds billowing from bomb craters in Tehran, but Iran has spent most of the 21st century as the region's rising power. Until recently, things had really been going its way. In Iraq, the U.S. toppled Saddam Hussein, then departed, having turned Iran's largest and most dangerous neighbor from an enemy to a vassal, even before Tehran's militias rescued Baghdad from ISIS, then stayed. The forces Iran sent to Syria did double duty, rescuing the Assad regime while opening an arms pipeline to Hezbollah, the Iran-backed militia fighting beside them. Based in Lebanon, Hezbollah was the crown jewel of the axis of resistance that Iran had arrayed against Israel. And for more than 80 years, opposition to Israel had defined the Middle East. For the Islamic Republic of Iran, it still does. Removal of the Jewish state from Islamic lands is core to the ideology of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which cast Iran in the unlikely role of leader of the Muslim world. America was the great Satan, but for Iran's proxies in Baghdad, Lebanon, and Yemen, Israel was the nearer target. So on the eve of October 7, 2023, the leaders of Hamas, the only prominent Palestinian node in the axis, had reason to assume that after breaching Israeli defenses on the Gaza Strip and pouring into Israel by the thousands, they would not be fighting alone for long. But the axis of resistance barely resisted at all. Hezbollah launched a few missiles a day toward Israel when the Zionist entity was most vulnerable. Iran's leaders had scanned the battlefield, and seeing an opponent backed not only by U.S. arms and intelligence, but also a nuclear arsenal, remembered why they were investing in one of their own, survival. In the words of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, creator of the theocratic system that governs Iran, the preservation of the system is the highest priority. Solidarity with the Palestinians was laudable, but there is also such a thing as self-interest. The problem for both Iran and the Palestinian cause is the rest of the Middle East had already come to the same conclusion. During the two decades, Iran was extending its military reach in the name of the Palestinians. The wealthy kingdoms of the Persian Gulf had been making common cause with the Jewish state. The fact is, most of the Arab world had made some accommodation or other with Israel. Egypt and Jordan, which share borders with Israel, signed peace treaties with it after suffering repeated military defeats at its hands. The Gulf states align with Israel in large part out of a shared enmity for Iran. As home to Islam's dominant Sunni branch, the kingdoms know Iran not only as radical, but also as the nominal leaders of the minority Shiite branch, thus a rival. Saudi Arabia, custodian of Islam's holy sites, has its own claim to leadership of the world's Muslims. As autocratic states, the Gulf kingdoms were also eager clients for an Israeli tech sector that had grown out of its military. Surveillance, not least of millions of Palestinians under occupation and obliged to use Israeli phone systems, generated startups like the spyware firm NSO Group, which soon found clients in the Arab regimes. One, the United Arab Emirates, was the first nation to cement diplomatic ties with Israel under the Abraham Accords, the signal diplomatic achievement of the first Trump administration. Three other Arab states followed, and the Saudis keep signaling their intention to do the same once the situation in Gaza permits. But Gaza churns on. A war Israel had not expected and has no plan to win, because at bottom it's not a military affair. The Palestinian question, what to do about the people who claim the same land Jewish Israelis do, will still be waiting when the shooting stops. The war on Iran, by contrast, is one Israel spent years planning for and opened with the playbook of deception, decapitation, precision strikes on missile sites that decimated Hezbollah in the space of a month last September, freeing Israelis from the dread of the militia's 100,000 missiles and exposing Iran to the Israeli offensive that began June 13. That day, a shepherd posted cell phone footage of an Israeli C-130 low in the sky over Syria, sheep bells clanking over the roar of engines. The Assad family had fled the country months earlier, helpless to keep rebels out of Damascus without Hezbollah. Iran sent a plane to evacuate its generals to Tehran. There, the question is how Israel will choose to define victory. Regime change did not go so well in Iraq, and the stated goal of demolishing Iran's nuclear facilities appeared impossible without U.S. airstrikes. That decision rested with Donald Trump. His choice may alter the region in unforeseen ways, but by reaching past the Palestinians to embrace Israel, as well as the sheikhs of the Gulf, the U.S. president already has described the contours of its new, more transactional reality. In 1945, the mere prospect of an Israeli state inspired a boycott by every Arab one in the name of the Palestinians. 80 years later, an Arab nation can declare outrage that 55,000 have been killed in Gaza, then dispatch jets to intercept Iranian missiles aimed at Tel Aviv, joining Israeli warplanes in the skies over a new Middle East. This edition of Time features some of their lists, innovators and titans. I'm going to read one page from that multi-page list. Mixue, M-I-X-U-E, one word, Global Fast Food Magnet, by Miranda Jayaratnam. It is the biggest fast food chain you've likely never heard of, at least if you live in the Western Hemisphere. Known for ice cream as cheap as 50 cents and drinks for around $1, Mixue overtook Starbucks and McDonald's last year as the world's largest food and beverage chain in store count. It has over 45,000 stores across mainland China and more than a dozen other regions. Mixue, which began as a street stall in the Chinese city of Zhengzhou, selling shaved ice and cold drinks, has long been focused on rapid proliferation through franchising, which has allowed the company to scale up quickly. There's a photograph here of a lopsided ice cream cone. It's in one of what I consider the old-fashioned conical cones, and it looks purplish, so maybe it's a berry flavor. It's twisty, like the soft-serve ice creams that we have available. Berkshire Hathaway, two words, long-term vision, by Alana Samuels. Investment trends come and go, but Berkshire Hathaway has stuck with a simple idea. Buy undervalued companies and invest in them for the long term. The strategy helped Warren Buffett build a struggling textile company into a behemoth that operates insurance firms, household brands, utilities, even a railroad. In 2024, the company outperformed the S&P 500, marked 9 straight years of positive results, and reached $1 trillion in market valuation. In March, at the age of 94, Buffett announced he'll step down at the end of the year and hands the reins to his chosen successor, Greg Abel. That's spelled A-B-E-L. And here's a photo of my fellow Omahan, Warren Buffett, the distinguished gentleman, wearing a banker's pinstripe suit, white shirt, red dotted tie. And he's smiling almost at the camera. He has white hair. DoorDash, one word, delivering worldwide. U.S. food delivery giant DoorDash is flexing its global muscle. In May, just months after settling with New York State and agreeing to pay $16.75 million over its delivery worker pay practices, DoorDash announced a $3.9 billion deal to acquire UK-based Deliveroo, expanding its reach to 40 countries. Jen Thomas wrote that, and Deliveroo is spelled D-E-L-I-V-E-R-O-O, much more fun to say. TSMC, AI, that's AI kingmaker. Surging demand for its cutting-edge AI chips helped Taiwan-based TSMC, the world's largest chip maker, beat analyst estimates in the first quarter of 2025. But those chips place it in the center of the U.S.-China trade war. In March, it pledged to spend $100 billion making chips in the U.S. Here are a couple more that I'm going to try and cover for you. Mercado Libre, dominant retailer, by Novid Parsi. Mercado Libre, called the Amazon of Latin America, surpassed 100 million unique annual buyers in its e-commerce business in 2024. Its fintech business processed $197 billion with its banking app Mercado Pago, or Pago, P-A-G-O, now serving more than 60 million monthly users. It is Brazil's biggest retailer. ARM, A-R-M, undergirding tech. This is by Allison Van Houten. Nearly every smartphone on the planet is powered by ARM's technology. ARM designs chip architecture, the set of instructions that tell a device what to do, and licenses it to manufacturers like Apple and NVIDIA. ARM's performance and efficiency beat competitors, and its chip designs reach more users by orders of magnitude. ARM generated over $4 billion in revenue from April 2024 to April 2025. Also by Van Houten, Comcast, NBC Universal. Wow, Comcast, space, NBC Universal, one word, melding media. Media conglomerate Comcast, NBC Universal had fingers in every pie in 2024. From Paris Olympics coverage, averaging 30.4 million viewers each day, to Universal Pictures' Wicked, which became the highest-grossing Broadway adaptation ever, and opening Epic Universe in Orlando in May. Procter & Gamble, consistency over disruption. P&G's recipe for success is steadiness. The maker of Crest, Tide, and other staples has paid shareholders a quarterly dividend for 135 consecutive years and saw a 17% spike in stock price from January to December 2024 as it shored up its supply chain. In June, however, it announced it will cut 7,000 jobs over 2 years, given the unpredictable geopolitical environment. Walmart by Jared Linzon. Walmart's strategy to revamp its e-commerce offerings and attract more affluent customers has been paying off. It saw record growth in 2024 in Walmart Plus memberships, and the percentage of higher-earning $100,000-plus U.S. households. The company's stock price surged 72% from January to December 2024, outpacing rivals Costco and Amazon. And here's Amazon, leading force by Alana Samuels. Amazon started in shopping, but now it is a global leader in cloud computing and is using that expertise to become a major force in AI. The behemoth is designing its own chips and building the world's largest AI computer cluster in Texas to gain even more market share. Alexa Plus, its new AI assistant, rolled out in spring. Universal Music Group, Defending Artists, by Soumya Krishnamurthy. When one of the world's largest record labels was sued by its own artist, Drake, over label mate Kendrick Lamar's hit, Not Like Us, its defense argued that diss tracks are a celebrated art form. Universal Music Group has also worked with Spotify, Deezer, YouTube, and TikTok to improve artist royalties and establish AI guardrails. Huawei, Huawei, pivotal tech firm, by Charlie Campbell. As China's tech ambitions feel the squeeze from U.S. export controls, Huawei has been entrusted to plug the gap. The company's developing several next-generation technologies, including 6G, cloud, and EVs. Huawei's Ascend 910C AI chip rivals NVIDIA's latest H100 AI-powered semiconductor chips. Meta, M-E-T-A, Making Friends, by Billy Perigo. In April, Mark Zuckerberg told a podcaster the average American has demand for meaningfully more friends. The Meta CEO's solution involves populating feeds with AI friends who know users by their data. In June, Meta spent $14.3 billion to gain a 49% stake in startup Scale AI in a bid to catch up to rivals like OpenAI. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.